weather today in the Grand.
I love you so badly, I could.
They're solid plastic, so don't settle for imitation.
But the senator, while insisting he was not intoxicated, could not explain his nudity.
Good evening, this is Eva Klein, and this is the Best of an Alan Smithy podcast. You give us 74 minutes and we'll give you 74 minutes of words. Just when you thought it was safe to go back into the departure lounge, tonight's double feature episode asks what's slower than a speeding bullet and able to hit tall buildings at a single bound. From the 15th of January, 2011, The Birth of Zaz, 1980's Airplane, directed by Jim Abrahams and David Zucker and Jerry Zucker, and, from, 1982 Airplane 2, the sequel, directed by Ken Finkelman.
Everybody, well, welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for about 1 hour. Our two movies this week are Airplane and Airplane 2, the sequel. And, Leslie Nielsen just died. He's only in the first one. The two of them... Let's see. I mean, I guess the two of them kind of... To begin with, the first one is... Not many people know this, but it's actually... they take the whole scenario of the crew and passengers of an airplane having food poisoning from this 1957 movie called Zero Hour with Dana Andrews and a couple of other kind of B-level stars. And some of the lines are actually taken verbatim that are meant to be funny in Airplane, like, you know, our chances for survival depend on finding someone who can fly this plane who didn't have fish for dinner. But when it came out in 80, there had been a series of movies called Airport, and it went like Airport, Airport 77, Airport 79, something like that. And in the original, Karen Black is a stewardess, and the crew goes sick, and she has to fly the plane. There was like a big coffee table book about movies of the 70s that came out a couple years ago called "The Stewardess Is Flying the Plane," and that's what that's taken from. people kind of assumed it was like just a spoof in particular of the Airport series, but you know, more than that. Airplane's an important movie because the spoof genre it existed before Airplane, but it wasn't exactly popular. I think the only kind of similar stuff you can look at is, Woody Allen's What's Up, Tiger Lily, which is even more conceptual. But the conceptual, really smart idea at the core of Airplane is that it uses these serious actors like Lloyd Bridges and, at the time, Leslie Nielsen. And it kind of takes this really simple potboiler kind of thriller plot and inserts all the silliness around that. And because people at the time, I think, didn't quite get that, they kind of thought that, you know, the reason people liked Airplane was because it was just silly. And it became, you know, the idea of doing a spoof movie just became like, take the plot, take the cliched plot of something and put in a bunch of silly jokes. But the masterstroke of Airplane is using actors like Lloyd Bridges and Robert Stack and at the time Leslie Nielsen, and you know, people don't even know that Leslie Nielsen played serious parts before Airplane, but he did, and that's why they used him. And, you know, I mean, the guys who made this movie, the Zucker brothers and Jim Abrams, they'd also done Kentucky Fried Movie, which has a bunch of great spoofs of TV and movies and stuff. But, you know, even in the movies that they did after this that were spoofs, like Top Secret with Val Kilmer, or, the Naked Gun movies with Leslie Nielsen, it's sort of like those movies didn't structure themselves in terms of like casting and stuff around the way around the real thing, the way that Airplane did for serious movies with serious guys. And I mean, the thing about modern spoofs is that like everybody in the movie seems to know that they're in on a spoof, whereas Airplane, like, everybody's playing it very straight-faced. It's almost like the characters in the movie don't know that they're in a spoof, and that's what really makes it work. But it was kind of it's kind of epochal in a way that people don't really point out. And something I noticed watching it this time, I think the last time was, I don't know, at least 3 or 4 years ago, but I never noticed that the music was by Elmer Bernstein. And the music's great because, like the casting, it's serious. It's got a serious, like, thriller, plane out of control, we've got to land this thing, exciting, suspenseful score. And Elmer Bernstein's a really good sport for doing the thankless task of creating a serious score for a movie that's a joke but won't work as a joke nearly as well if the score isn't as, you know, deadpan serious as a lot of the other stuff that's happening. And the other movie that he kind of did that for was John Landis's Animal House, which doesn't have a lot of like wacky music in it, if I recall correctly. It's sort of like a score. It's like a score for a movie about college. And Elmer Bernstein rules. He did great music for American Werewolf in London, which is our last episode.
Yeah.
But I hadn't noticed that before. It's neat.
It's sort of, yeah, I mean, the music in it is just, it's, well, some of it, you know, the opening, of course, is the Jaws takeoff.
Right.
And from that moment, you know, the score sort of establishes itself as an important feature, especially since the movie jumps around so much. With the flashback for Ted Stryker, you really, you know, the music helps bridge that kind of thing. And it plays up the whole melodramatic quality of the mm-hmm. grand romance. The thing I noticed watching this time was this movie makes fun of Vietnam veterans.
Huh. I hadn't noticed that.
It makes fun of the Vietnam War, something that I don't think is even done yet today, really.
Like, oh yeah, Ted Stryker. He makes all these references to the war, but again, I guess now that you mention it, that was probably some kind of Vietnam allusion.
Yeah, and I mean, it's still a subject that's handled very delicately today. You know, 35 years later, or no, longer than that now, and where there's Airplane coming out, you know, 5 years later, and it's just poking fun at the whole idea of it in some ways. I mean, obviously, it's Vietnam standing in for the Korean War from Zero Hour, I imagine, but
yeah,
just watching it this time, it was just kind of funny that they got away with it back then without the assail from everyone. The other thing I kind of forgot about was the requisite PG nudity.
Oh yeah,
which is just
yeah, that's right. We were in our last episode. We were talking about how far Popeye and Flash Gordon pushed the PG envelope, but yeah, this movie is PG and it has a pair of bare breasts. That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, and considering that, well, I mean, when you think about the target audience when it came out, it had to appeal to 12-year-old boys and people who would get Barbara Billingsley being in it. So presumably the 12-year-old boys could watch reruns, but it's really interesting how
I think it's kind of an all ages movie, actually, between the old B movie spoofs and the just kind of pie in the face stuff. I was surprised Peter Graves was willing to do jokes where he's a pedophile. I mean, wouldn't the guy have still had like kind of a serious acting career going on at this time? And it's the guy from Mission Impossible talking about getting a little boy to look at his crotch. I mean, that's a lot funnier than hey, you're Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. which is a pretty specific 70s era kind of like, you know, sports stars cameoing in movies like O.J. Simpson and stuff. But, yeah, Peter Graves as a child molester is even funnier to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of...
I mean, that's the thing. This movie's got pretty risque humor, doesn't it? I mean, even for the time.
And it just gets away with everything, and it just was inducted into the Library of Congress this year.
Yeah, yeah.
So I mean, it's like it's sort of just been totally accepted as a cultural icon in a way that I doubt.
I think people just kind of accept it and its legacy without really understanding the context for it. Because I kind of thought about this movie a lot, like in the last, you know, in the aughts, in the thousands, because we had all these goddamn, you know, scary movie 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and epic movie, and superhero movie, and Not Another Teen Movie, and all that stuff. And it was just like so obvious that all those movies were created by putting the scenes from trailers together and adding dick jokes, and everybody knows they're in on the joke. And it's like, okay, yeah, Airplane does recycle a lot from Zero Hour and from Airport, but it's more like it's poking fun at the idea of movies that take themselves seriously. It's almost like ushering in this new era where movies aren't allowed to be as serious as they used to be, or we're just going to laugh at them because it'll remind us of Airplane.
Right. Well, I think that it doesn't, and I don't want to get to Airplane 2 yet. What Airplane doesn't do is it doesn't actually have that many pop culture references to other media.
It's true.
Yes, it's sort of what Airport 75 with Karen Black and Exorcist girl and the singing nun and Charlton Heston, who somehow, you know, they couldn't woo him in for a cameo, even though he would have been perfect in this.
right.
It in Zero Hour is the template, but it's not like in the Jaws opening, but that's the only Jaws reference. I mean, there's no Star Wars references. There's no,
probably the most topical parody of an unrelated movie that goes on for any length of time is the Saturday Night Fever disco scene.
Right. And then the From Here to Eternity scene that I read that the guys had never seen it, Which
yeah, I read that too, but it's sort of, which is prescient because now everybody does parodies of things that they've never seen.
But the thing is that they get the funniest part wrong.
What is the funniest part?
In the inserts, their hair isn't wet. In the close-up inserts, their hair's not wet, and so I kept waiting for it.
Yeah.
And it never came, and I'm like, well, in color. You know, and that's seen in black and white, whatever, you know, the shadows, something you're taking it seriously so you can let it go. But when you're seeing it, it would have just been hilarious if their hair had been dry and they don't.
yeah. The references to other media, they're kind of, sometimes they're a little disorienting. I mean, sometimes they're kind of like quasi-classical, like Lieutenant Hurwitz thinks he's Ethel Merman,
right?
And they actually have Ethel Merman. That's like a very modern kind of gag to do, except now it would be like Lady Gaga, I guess. Like, there's the weirdest joke to me is when the woman's husband is like throwing up some, or he gets the steak and not the fish or something, and then there's a slow zoom on the guy's wife, and you hear her thinking, "Oh, Ted never gets the steak." And then later the follow up is, you know, "Ted never throws up at home." And I guess that's from a commercial that was airing at the time.
Yeah, I think it's from a coffee commercial.
Yeah, that's probably the only really. I mean, they don't do that many, so it's not bad that that's the only kind of pop culture reference that has really been forgotten and is just kind of confusing.
Right. And so you just see it as sort of a goofy little moment as opposed to being a reference to the shows. But that brings into it that Airplanes, the audience for Airplane today is more people who, oh, that's a frightening thought, that the audience for Scary Movie in 20 years will be 40-year-olds or, wow. But no, I mean, the audience for Airplane is more people who, you know, were consuming media in the 70s to some degree, not overall, but you know, the Barbara Billingsley reference, I didn't remember who she was. I just remember she was somebody famous and that it was funny that it was Barbara Billingsley. I didn't remember until I looked it up that it was June Cleaver.
Right. Yeah, and if you don't know who she is, then it's just funny that, you know, an old lady speaks jive. So it's still funny on some level, even without getting the joke, where it's like 20 years from now, like, how are you going to get stupid specific references to, I don't know, to like Justin Bieber or whatever they're putting
right
in space now? Like all this really specific name stuff that's not clever enough to be funny beyond the context of what it is that they're parodying. And that's kind of why I hate the Saturday Night Fever scene so much, because it relies entirely on you thinking that disco is funny, or that like, hey, look, you recognize this, now we're doing it in a movie that's not what we're doing the parody of. You can almost, it's like, it's a bit like seeing the future of bad spoofs in that one scene. And by the way, because it's my least favorite scene, of course, it's Roger Ebert's favorite scene. He says in his 1980 review, "The movie's funniest scene, however, occurs in a flashback explaining how the stewardess and the Air Force pilot first met and fell in love years ago. The scene takes place in an exotic Casablanca-style bar, which is miraculously transformed when someone's hurled at the jukebox and it starts playing Stayin' Alive by the Bee Gees. The scene becomes a hilarious send-up of the disco scenes in Saturday Night Fever, with the young pilot defying gravity to impress the girl." That's how lame Roger Ebert is.
That actually explains all of his film criticism to me right now. That he thought that defying gravity makes something funny. Well, I mean, that scene, all that scene did now was remind me that I haven't seen Saturday Night Fever in a long time, and, you know,
yeah,
Maybe I should see it again. I'd love to get a hold of the upbeat PG version and compare it to the downbeat R-rated version. But no, I mean, that scene, I mean, some of the problem is that my problem with the movie is how much it relies on Haggerty and Hayes.
Uh-huh.
Who are so bland that it just seems like I think that's one of the things that actually the sequel has going for it, is that you've at least been around them for one movie. So, because Airplane has to establish them, and because it has a narrative, it's not just a spoof, you get sort of these, their lame sort of love story, and I think that is one of the conceptual problems I have with it, that in a disaster movie, you get Burt Lancaster for that role. In this, they got nobody for it. Right. And they filled out the supporting cast with established actors. I just think that Hayes, and I mean, Hayes is genial and likable enough, but I mean, God, I saw the guy in something, you know, in 1997. I'm like, oh, it's the guy from Airplane. I mean, it's like, talk about typecasting. I mean, like,
yeah,
the poor guy.
The only movie I can think of with Julie Haggerty off the top of my head is that she plays Tom Green's mom in Freddy Got Fingered.
Was she ever in a... Did she maybe do a Woody Allen? Maybe, possibly, do a Woody Allen?
I don't know.
I mean, yeah, she just fell off the face of the earth, too.
Well, it's like, what the heck do you do after this? People are like, well, we can't cast you in a serious movie.
And cause... I mean, it changed everybody who was in its sort of career path in some ways. I mean, Peter Graves
that's
was
part...
able to do
yeah,
TV,
that's...
right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what amazes me, is that, like, you know, Lloyd Bridges and Peter Graves, like, and you know, they weren't washed up at the time. This could have, like, potentially ruined them. It's not like they weren't in Leslie Nielsen's position where he was, like, getting old and did need to reinvent himself by spoofing himself.
Yeah, and I mean, so just totally. Well, I mean, look at Leslie Nielsen. What, Prom Night was 79?
No, Prom Night was the same year as this.
Okay, so he was, you know, not to be impolite to the Canadian film industry, he was slumming it in Canada in, mm-hmm. you know, really unscary and very stupid slasher takeoffs that, you yeah. know, presumably yeah. they bought Jamie Lee Curtis a car or something. And right. then all of a sudden, he's in this. He gets Police Squad a couple years later, which then gets turned around and turned into, you know, turns him into the Leslie Nielsen everybody knew from 1987 to 1999 or whenever he stopped, you know, doing theatrical releases. And so, right. I mean, it's just like, for him, it must have been an incredible boon. But yeah, just for Robert Stack, you know, he did Unsolved Mysteries, but had he decided that he wasn't going to worry about getting a serious job ever again?
Yeah, that's the question. Lloyd Bridges also, like, surely he considered the thought that this would lose him some serious work in the future.
But maybe people didn't worry about it. And that's one of the funny things that the guy, Bryan Cranston, who's on Breaking Bad, was giving an interview about that, and that's his, you know, he's been around for 20 years or 30 years, and that was his first lead in a serious role and all this. And he said that, you know, in the 70s and 80s, you didn't really worry about what you did. Mm. You know, because the odds were you were up for a role. Somebody hadn't seen the episode of Chips you were on because they had no easy way to refer to it. You just didn't put it on your application. You just didn't put it on your credits. This is Airplane. It was a huge success, you know, and so everybody would have seen it. So in some ways, it gave Leslie Nielsen his career, but just in terms of typecasting for the leads and other stuff, there are other people on it that I'm like, I've never seen these people again. And you would have thought you would have.
Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. She was, Julie Haggerty was the wife in What About Bob? That's right. Remember that?
Yes, I do.
She was also Albert Brooks's wife in Lost in America. So she did some comedies.
She did do some comedies, yeah.
Because what the heck else could she do afterward? Let's see. Yeah. Well, here's some more stuff from Roger Ebert's ignorance. Airplane is practically a satirical anthology of classic movie cliches. Not completely true. Okay, and then he mentions Lloyd Bridges, the Jaws parody, the Win One for the Gipper reference. None of this really adds up to great comic artistry, but Airplane compensates for its lack of original comic invention by its utter willingness to steal, beg, borrow, and rewrite from anywhere. No. That's what modern parodies, spoofs, like the scary movie-inspired stuff do. Epic movie steals, begs, borrows, and rewrites from anywhere. Epic movie has jokes about Charlie and the Chocolate Factory next to jokes about Borat. That's not what Airplane is. Airplane is pretty specifically a parody of two or three types of melodramatic disaster-type film. Yeah. There's kind of a warm up to Airplane in the Kentucky Fried Movie. Like a disaster movie trailer parody called That's Armageddon. You ever see Kentucky Fried Movie?
No.
It's funny.
Yeah.
It's funny, but yeah, I mean, you know, I guess if I had seen it and then I heard that Airplane was coming out, like I wouldn't really have a lot of faith in the guys who made Kentucky Fried Movie to do a feature length spoof, but you know, maybe in a way that's kind of what Airplane also did first, is that they sustained a single premise of spoofing for 90 minutes, because Kentucky Fried Movie was a collection of spoofs. And then there was, like, in the late 70s, there was, like, Movie. I think George Burns is in that, but that's, as the title suggests, it's, like, two different parodies of movies with the idea that, like, you're going to a double feature. It was like the Grindhouse of its day.
Well, the big bus, which nobody really talks about, is basically Airplane on a Bus a few years earlier.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a spoof of a disaster movie. And it's interestingly, it's from Paramount. So it's almost as though Paramount kept trying to get a spoof series that would work for them. But yeah, no, it's from 76. It's got the same casting principle. You know, you've got, well, I mean, in this one, though, they were a little bit more... Stockard Channing's the girl, so she was able to do other stuff. But, you know, and then they got Ned Beatty's in it, Ruth Gordon, Larry Hagman. I don't know if Dallas would have started, but yeah, Lynn Redgrave. So I mean, it's an interesting precursor to Airplane in that in some ways I think it's more like the modern spoof than Airplane is. The Big Bus is more like Airplane 2 than Airplane is like the Big Bus.
Okay.
I would say, but I'm reading these notes, and apparently Robert Hayes and Julie Haggerty were cast last. They brought in everybody else first.
Yeah, well, I could see that. I guess they couldn't. I guess they really couldn't get anyone known to star in this, because, I mean, yeah, it's pre-IMDb, but you would be worried that you couldn't get serious. Get serious roles after that, and that's exactly what happened to them. Although, I don't know, Robert Hayes. Let's see what old Robert Hayes was in after this, besides Airplane 2.
Starman!
Wait a minute. Oh, okay. I've only seen Starman once, so I don't remember it too well.
Oh, no, not the movie, the TV show.
There's a Starman TV show?
Oh, yeah, it's a sequel. It's one of the first TV shows as sequels, not remakes. He comes back to Earth years later, and yeah.
Wow, look at that. You're right.
He was in Trenchcoat, which I've always wanted to see. Roger Ebert hates it, apparently. But it's it was a Margot Kidder vehicle.
Wow, he also... Robert Hayes also played Iron Man. the Marvel Iron Man in an Iron Man cartoon. Oh, okay, I was hoping it was a live action show.
Yeah, no. But I mean, the guy's only like 63 now, so he should be working. But apparently, oh wait, he came back for superhero movie.
Boy, yeah, that's kind of. I keep harping on the scary movie franchises, but even though Zuckers and Abrams didn't start them, they did do work on some of them later on.
Yeah, they came back after it was too expensive to bring back the Wayans brothers, which is just... What's so funny is that, you know, I don't know. I mean, these guys' this entire career sort of rose and fell on the Naked Gun in some ways, and you gotta wonder... I don't know if anybody's ever talked about it, but didn't Naked Gun 3 come out right before the OJ thing? Because I remember Leslie Nielsen saying, "No way he did it!"
Huh.
Yeah.
Frank Drebin said that, huh?
Yeah.
I guess it would have been about 95, 94, 95-ish.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I still haven't seen that one. I still haven't seen the third one.
Naked Gun 33 and a third.
Yeah.
The Final Assault.
So, but I mean, that was kind of the end of them, because before that,
well, yeah,
yeah, around the second one, they were just everywhere. Oh, that's right. Then they wanted to be serious, so they did First Night and Ghost and that sort of thing. I forgot about that.
Oh, that the Zuckers did. Yeah, that's right. I forget that too.
They broke up. Zaz broke up, and they did all that stuff. And then they started getting back together for Scary Movie when pretty much nothing worked out. Mm. And then they did Ruthless People, which wasn't a spoof, and it wasn't good either, which is interesting. Mm. But yeah,
it's kind of funny though. Like I'm looking at at their filmographies and stuff, and like there still were spoof movies in the 90s. I mean, the genre it never really went away. It just kind of there wasn't anything as popular as the scary movies and the Naked Guns in between those, but in between those you still had like High School High and Basketball. So
yeah, what's funny is that, well, then Basketball was the other thing, and yeah, I mean, they're just
it's all they knew how to do.
Except the one guy who did Ghost. I mean, hey, there you go. But and then they broke up and they did their other stuff, Jane Austen's Mafia. So, I mean, it's just a really interesting...
Oh, God, yeah. Remember that.
With
oh,
Lloyd Bridges. Shots. And Hot Shots, right? Hot Shots with...
Hot Shots and Hot Shots Part Deux. Yeah, these guys are like an American institution, but...
Not a solid one. They're like an American institution that started falling apart over the years.
Yeah.
But apparently like, very early, because I assumed that they did the Naked Gun series together, and they didn't.
Hmm. That was just Jim Abrams, huh?
Well, wait, no.
Oh, wait a minute. No, they did.
They did? Yeah, there they are.
Yeah.
But, yeah, plus, so...
Yeah, and Leslie Nielsen is inseparable from their brand. Although he didn't come back in Airplane 2.
Because it wasn't their brand.
Right. They actually disowned it before it came out. Like, they said they were gonna do it, and then they said no, and then it got made anyway without them. But they still brought back a whole lot of they still brought back a whole lot of people.
Yeah, so is that our segue?
Yeah. Oh, one more thing about Airplane 1.
Okay.
Apparently Christopher Lee turned down the Leslie Nielsen role. So Leslie Nielsen and Donald Pleasance both owe the second halves of their career to Christopher Lee turning down their roles first, because of course Christopher Lee turned down Dr. Loomis in Halloween.
I'd forgotten that. Yes.
So Airplane 2, not a Zaz production.
Not a Zaz production. It's from Ken Finkelman, who I don't think anybody remembered his name until he's a Canadian. He wrote Grease 2. He wrote Who's That Girl with Madonna. And then in the 90s, he wrote this show called The Newsroom.
Yeah, which is apparently really popular.
Yes.
Was really popular, even though I've never heard of it, but that's Canada.
Yeah, and so I remember talking to someone about The Newsroom at one point, and they were like, oh yeah, that's a great show. I'm like, you know what the writer did before this? And they were like, what? And I'm like, Airplane 2. And they were just shocked. So his approach to it is basically to take Airplane and add some space stuff, add a romantic foil for Ted Stryker, and then basically tell every single joke over again.
Yeah, it's kind of sad. I mean, he like repeats all the, you know, I guess it's kind of useful because it lets you know that the lines that people are still quoting today from Airplane were apparently just as popular at the time, because Airplane 2 does recycle all of the best bits. But it also recycles some of the minor bits that had to do with like extra characters, and they recycled them just because they could get the actors back.
Right.
Like the lady who's so hysterical that everybody starts slapping her. They brought her back like just so that they could, and so that they could fill up another 30 seconds of screen time. Now, granted, like, I mean, it must have been pretty daunting to, you know, set about doing writing Airplane 2 and coming up with like so many friggin' jokes. If that's, you know, not your style, but the thing about the jokes he adds is, okay, like Ken Finkelman definitely didn't get what made Airplane special, because I mean, he has the crutch of recycling the scenario of Airplane and the jokes and characters and stuff, but all of his jokes that he adds are either total silliness and not even as funny of silliness as the first movie had. And then he adds a lot of jokes about airline travel and flying, and Sonny Bono plays a terrorist with a bomb, which is some pre-9/11.
I actually think that might be from another airplane movie.
Well, oh sure, yeah, Airport.
It's
right.
From Airport One, I think, actually.
Oh.
But they also add a lot of other references, like there's a 2001 reference, you know.
But I hate the space stuff because, like, it does, none of it matters. Like, I know, it was made between Star Wars movies and space stuff was hot, but it's like they don't actually have the budget to make it a science fiction parody. It's not a science fiction parody.
It's just a future movie. Yeah, it's just
but it's not like a near future movie. It's like everything is still the present except for the fact that they're going to the moon. It's really weird.
See, I wondered if the space stuff wasn't just sort of, you know, sort of the same way that Dino De Laurentiis thought he had to do a space movie. They were just like, well, let's just make it in space now.
That's all it was.
But
yeah.
I think that it might have had something to do more with Star Trek than with Star Wars, just with Shatner showing up. And I think that that's why this one always has, like, I have a soft spot for it. Because, yeah, I mean, the jokes are recycled and everything, but Shatner shows up and is just, it gives him a...
People weren't used to him being silly back then.
I mean, like, this was T.J. Hooker. I mean, like, T.J. Hooker's freaking hilarious.
This came out the same year as Wrath of Khan.
Right. You know, Wrath of Khan's not funny. He never makes fun of himself in a Star Trek movie. But, you know, this is just the side to William Shatner that you didn't really get to see for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, right, until more recently.
I mean, Rip Torn's in this. I mean, there's a funny little Rip Torn cameo. It's like... And John Vernon. So in some ways, this one has
Chuck Connors. Like it's like he knew enough about the first movie that he thought, oh, I should get I should get serious B movie actors. But then he's not like Ken Finkelman isn't like clever enough to mock their personas. He just
they're just there.
He, They're just there, and like, you know, Chuck Connors has a cigarette put out in his coffee. Ha ha.
And
like,
I mean,
those are the jokes.
And so it has, Joyce DeWitt's in it somewhere. I guess I didn't see her in it, but yeah. Sure. And well, the thing, did you notice that it appears that Robert Hayes' voice was dubbed for his first scene in this?
I didn't notice that. I thought his performance overall was a lot like more man. Well, okay, yeah, he's supposed to be institutionalized, even though he's not really crazy. But I feel like Robert Hayes probably went up to Finkelman and he was like, "Hey, I had to play it, you know, so straight in the first one. Let me be a little wacky in this one." So he does a lot more. His acting is a lot more high energy.
Yeah. So, you know, and this one has a more. Is it longer than the first one? It seems longer in some ways.
I think it just seems longer.
Because they do a lot more. Because once they get on the plane, there's all sorts of stuff they have to do with the... There's intrigue this time. Before, there wasn't exactly intrigue. It was... And the flashbacks in this are less pronounced, I think, once you get to the moon and stuff. And, yeah, I mean...
I was... They flash back to the first airplane, which was shocking. The thing about this, I always sort of assumed that even though it was called Airplane 2, the sequel, that it was mainly a remake because it was in the future or the near future or whatever. And even though it was Julie Haggerty and Robert Hayes again, that they were just, that it was like a, you know, Return of the Living Dead 2 kind of thing. But it's like... No, it's where they bring back James Caron and Tom Matthews. But it's like, no, it's a real sequel. It directly references the events of the first movie.
Yeah.
And I wasn't prepared for that. And I, you know, it's a cheap trick to endear you a little bit. But like you were saying, like, there is something about the familiarity with Julie Haggerty and Hayes at this point that makes it a little more bearable.
Yeah, I think it helps with them in particular because it's no longer establishing them and they're no longer unknowns. I mean, I don't know. It's a weird thing that with the first one that they just aren't. They don't have so much. It gives them gravitas that they don't actually have, but they sort of inherit it just by. Being a sequel. Now, Bernstein did the music, same cinematographer, so they just are...
He did, Bernstein did the original music, and they brought in some arranger to do a little extra stuff to rip off the theme to Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, that's what that's from. Okay. Yeah, I forgot
about
that.
The movie opens with the theme to Battlestar Galactica. I mean, with a you know, Star Wars crawl, and and then it totally doesn't follow up on any kind of science fiction parody stuff. There's like an ET gag in the first 5 minutes, and that's,
yeah, the beginning of this is a lot gag heavier than the other one, where you had to pay attention to the loading and unloading. This, it's almost immediate that it starts going nuts.
Yeah, that's true. No, that's true. Yeah, I mean, there is kind of a demarcation point in the first airplane. I think it's when, because there's like some normal scenes of people arriving at the airport, and then I think the first joke that lets you know that we're about to be silly now is the voiceover announcers arguing with each other about the white zone and the red zone for parking. And in this one, it just dives right into it because let's see. It's very, you know, the sense of humor in this movie, it's very Canadian Jewish, and it was made by a Canadian Jew, and it is irreverent. I mean, he does go for the bad taste sometimes, but it's just kind of lame irreverent. It's like a 13-year-old's idea of irreverent. You could accuse the first movie of being, you know, I guess if the first airplane was like Mad Magazine, this is like the cracked version.
Now, you were mentioning the special effects earlier. What I did find amusing was the special effects in this are still better than the special effects in The Last Starfighter.
Huh. Yeah, no, they are pretty good, actually.
For what they are, it's kind of incredible that
they're better. It's kind of weird that they're so good and then there's no jokes around them. Like, there's shots of like the plane like going through an asteroid field that looked great. But there's no like jokes about the asteroids or something. Like, you know, the plane is going through asteroids and then like one of them is a giant donut or something and it goes through the hole. There's nothing like that. It's just good. It's just good space stuff because that's what moviegoers in 1982 were expecting. Now, it's got that kind of pseudo futuristic production design, like the inside of the cockpit and stuff. But no future stuff. If you get the idea. I don't know where to bring this up, so I'll just bring it up now. But this is the kind of movie, I mean, you know, both these kind of movies are kind of like a lazy Sunday afternoon movie. And I remember watching Airplane 2 as a kid, like I rented it. And in the first 10 minutes or something, there's that joke where it's like, oh, sorry, we can't take your dog aboard. We're going to have to put him down. And they pretend to shoot him. I remember my mom like hearing that scene from the other room and going, and like, what are you watching? What is this? What is this? A degeneracy?
And that's then, like this failed joke. I mean, in the opening sequence, it's just so many gags that you're like, well, if they get what, you know, 60% of them, it works, right? But the putting the dog down joke, it's not because it's mean. It's not because it's just because it takes too long. The gag takes 45 seconds versus everything else that takes, you know.
Yeah, you know, percentage. I was thinking about percentages too, and I was thinking about like, well, there's, you know, there's a lot of jokes in both movies, and you know what, the best defense of this kind of movie is even if you don't like this joke, there's another one coming right away. You know, it's like it's the point Groucho Marx made when he looked at the camera 80 years ago and said they can't all be good. But I'd say the first movie hits about 70-80% of the jokes are funny, and then this one is more like, I don't know, it's 40% being too generous, probably more like 30. The problem I have with this movie is that like it's not witty enough. You kind of like in the first movie, like they would make jokes like, you know, don't call me Shirley and all together now, and you know,
I think they do one of those in here.
A hospital. What is it? It's a building with sick people, but that's not important. Like
they bring
that stuff
joke
was
back in here. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they bring back all that stuff, but I mean, those kind of silly moments were acceptable in the first one because of like, they were so silly and they were being performed straight faced and stuff. When Airplane 2 just goes for the flat out silliness, it's not as funny. So you're kind of, I found myself like constantly on edge that some little line of dialogue was about to become a terrible joke. Like if someone comes in and like if someone says like, why are you being so crabby? Like I didn't trust Ken Finkelman not to cut to someone with crab hands is what I'm trying to say. Like, I was always tensing up, like, oh no, how bad is the next one going to be? And then sometimes it is fun, like, you know, actually funny, but only about 30% of the time. And I'm not counting the repeat jokes where it's just, hey, remember this joke from the last
movie?
Right,
yeah, those don't count. It's what he has to come up with on his own. And he does. He is able to come up with some of his stuff on his own. The Sonny Bono thing, it falls flat by the time they get to the by the time they have to take the bomb away from him. That's a really complicated process because they're going to take the bomb away from him, and then they're going to use the bomb to either knock out the computer or to repower the atomic generator. And you're kind of like, what is this, a James Bond movie? Like, this is really complicated, and I don't need to be thinking about this. You know, this is a lot. And that, it's that kind of thing you're like, you got too much story here. You know, if the first movie kind of runs out of story and then they land the plane, this one, it runs out of story. You have this huge, complicated section where it's technical. And then they land the plane. And it's like, I'm not saying it's too jumbled, because...
Yeah. The other thing that makes it jumbled, too, is that, like, you know, they take off in this spaceship, and then the whole, like, all of the jokes in the middle of the movie could have been in the first one, but then when Shatner shows up at the end, he's on the moon, right?
Right, it's the moon
and then
base.
And then it's very space stuff heavy. Not that some of Shatner's jokes aren't funny or whatever, it's just like, it just reminds you, like, oh yeah, this is, I forgot they're on a spaceship, not an airplane.
The one joke that I love, that...
Yeah.
The dad and the family, when they do the repeat of the first one where people are listening, except they're running away from the father's rape charges.
Oh, right.
It's in such awful taste. I mean, it reminded me of Happiness. I'm like, this is just terrible. I'm like, that's great. I can't believe they did that. Like, where else are you going to see?
It was like Ken Finkelman reveling in the fact that the first movie opened up the possibility of pedophile jokes in PG-rated movies.
Yeah, you could get away with this. Yeah. And it's just like, yeah.
So that or a PG movie in 1982, anyway.
Which also had breasts, again, which really just tells you that the big anti-nudity swing started in, what, 83, I'd say?
Around, it sort of coincided with PG-13, yeah.
Well, I don't know, because PG-13's never had nudity, really. Did they?
Well, exactly. And it was like, you know, if you're going to have risque content, you got to have a lot of it or, like, none at all. I think that's when it started. PG-13 just kind of... It was like, I don't know, one swear word or something. It was almost... PG-13 was almost like a marketing tool more than a... Well, I mean, all the rating system is marketing tool. Anyway, I don't want to get too hung up on that. But,
but yeah, I mean,
The point is, you used to... In the early 80s, as recently as 1982, you could have tits in a PG movie. Yeah.
And the use of them in this was funny, too. I mean, it's the metal detector. I mean, they could have gone... The joke could have been better, but, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like there's some creativity, but it's just not.
Yeah, some of the jokes are actually like creative modifications of jokes from the original instead of outright swipes. Like, there's the scene in the first one where Robert Stack is, it looks like he's dressing himself in front of a mirror, but then he walks forward and he realizes that you're not looking at his reflection. He's, you know, just standing there in the hallway. And they do kind of the same thing with William Shatner, where he's talking on a computer monitor, and then he just opens the door, and it's not a monitor. He's just been talking through the window.
Yeah.
That's kind of funny.
It's
funny without having to, like, I don't know, bring back one of the black guys who spoke Jive in the first movie and just have him speak Jive again.
Yeah. Which, and then there's the Lloyd Bridges gets another picture in his picture or something.
Yeah. He even says something like, I feel like I've, you know, here we go again, something.
That's kind of the one thing, is that they bring back Lloyd Bridges, but then
he doesn't do anything.
He's just there for a second, and then Shatner's back, or Shatner's in that part. So,
yeah. And they brought back Peter Graves for another not as funny pedophile joke.
And another not as funny names of the pilots and stuff.
It's this weird cloying. I can't think of a sequel, even a comedy sequel, that like so heavily relies on you having like just seen the first one, like we did. In terms of like directly copying stuff, but getting away to directly copy it because
maybe it would play different after 2 years. I mean, if you think about it like that it was,
I know,
80
'cause
and 82.
Like, yeah, you didn't have home video to watch it over and over again, probably. So it's like when they're referencing those lines, I guess it is kind of, you know, maybe it was more refreshing at the time.
Yeah. Oh. I mean, but the whole idea of a sequel playing on the affection of the first one, that's sort of gone now.
It's a risky gambit, and movies like Escape from LA have kind of ensured that it doesn't get tried too much anymore.
Well, I was actually thinking of successful sequels. I mean, financially successful ones. Those freaking Bourne movies, like, you know, they generate no affection. The James Bond, the new ones, they don't do that. I mean, Airplane 1 and 2 have, you know, Lethal Weapon 2 and 3 have more in common with the Airplane movies than, say, it does with an action sequel today. Or even, you know, the first two Diehards, Airport movies and Airplane movies, they have more in common with Airplane 1 and 2 than they do with even Die Hard 3 and 4. I mean, the sequel has just changed in a lot of ways since this. And, I mean, Airplane 2 is called the sequel, so, I mean, obviously they're pointing out that sequels were not, you know, the norm, especially for a comedy. I mean, what other comedy had a sequel?
At the time in 1982, I think it was about to become a regular thing for comedies to have sequels, but it wasn't really the case at the time.
Well, I'm thinking about it. What was there? I mean, there's Ghostbusters and Ghostbusters 2.
Yeah, which were 5 years apart, 84, 89.
But,
I mean, like, Porky's had sequels, but the first Porky's came out the same year as Airplane 2. Revenge of the Nerds had sequels. That came, first one came out in 84. I really can't think of any off the top of my head.
Yeah, neither can I. So it's almost like Airplane kicked off the whole idea of a comedy being a franchise. And they wanted to make a third one. And it just, the response to Airplane 2 was not enough to get a third one made. So,
yeah. Just, you know who I'm kind of glad that they brought back in Airplane 2, but it's almost a microcosm of why Airplane 2 is a bad movie. They bring back Steven Stucker as the latently homosexual air traffic controller, who is so goddamn funny in the first one, and then
so lame in the second one.
And I swear they give him more lines in the second one.
They give him a second character. Or third. He has like three characters in it. He's just everywhere, and it's like he was funny in the first one. That doesn't mean that if more of him makes it better.
And Ken Finkelman doesn't know how to write funny fag talk like the Zuckers did.
Yeah. I mean, tragically. It's just,
There's nothing even not just as simple as there's a sale at Penny's. Too bad.
It's like Finkelman's strength with this one, besides the whole Shatner thing, was getting, you know, good cameos. Like John Vernon, that was a good cameo. Mm. Raymond Burr, that was a good cameo, that sort of thing. But having to adapt the original cast cameos and small roles to his new movie was just a disaster. And that whole, the whole romantic rival guy, God, I guess he's worked. I didn't think Chad Everett had ever worked again after this, but apparently he's had a fine career. He's awful. And it's not like he's acting opposite any, he's acting opposite Sonny Bono. The guy does not need to be that good of an actor. And he's awful.
He looks like a young, looks like a young Charles Napier. maybe it's the mustache.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a really, like, familiar-looking guy. I've definitely seen him in a million things without knowing his name.
Yeah, and he's just, and that whole thing is just, because, I mean, I was thinking too hard when I started watching it, and it had been, you know, if I saw Airplane 8 years ago, or it's been longer than that, I hadn't seen Airplane 2 since.
Yeah, I know. I think literally the last time for me was when my mom yelled at me for watching it.
Yeah, I haven't seen it since the last century, so...
right.
Yeah, and so I couldn't remember what Ted and What's-Her-Face, Julie Haggerty, were up to, and then there's the whole... And that's the funny thing, is why they feel the need to rehash the flashback structure. Because it's... Their troubles are not... You know...
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's like what they flash back to a trial, to Ted's trial, where characters from the first movie take the stand and flash back to their scenes from the first Airplane. It's just a mess.
And it's kind of like they don't embrace that whole idea of that they're actually remaking the first Airplane and calling it a sequel and just adding a little bit of stuff to it. I mean, maybe if they embrace that more, copying its structure would work. But they don't really embrace that. They just do it for the first, what, half hour? And then once they're... Then they're into their other thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't... Oh, sorry. No, I was just gonna say that I don't think... I think the bad rap it gets is undeserved in some ways.
Oh, well, you know, it's not completely worthless. It's just completely unnecessary.
Right.
Is the thing. Here's another piece of Ebert idiocy. In his review for Airplane 2, he makes this hilarious... Okay.
Go.
There was a strange thing about the original Airplane. Even though it was spoof, even though it was an anarchic put-on from beginning to end, it somehow did hook into our fears of flying. At some dumb basic level, we were concerned about how that airplane was ever going to get back to Earth again, and our concern gave the movie a narrative thread from beginning to end. Just like the original 1970 Airport, itself a pretty silly movie, the original spoof worked partly because of how we feel about airplanes.
Okay, now I haven't seen Airport in a while, but I'm pretty sure that you're worried about how it's going to end because, like, you like half the people on the plane and you want Dean Martin to get his comeuppance, and it actually does not have much to do with the fear of flying. You know, United 93 might have something to do with the fear of flying, right? Like,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And if the Zuckers want to show balls these days, they could do a spoof of that. But anyway... And that sort of review is just funny because it's Ebert writing it in 82 and he sounds so stupid.
Every time I read something like that, I can never believe that this guy wrote Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. I don't know. How do you go from a crown jewel of hipness writing a movie for Russ Meyer to making lame statements like airplane scared me because I'm scared of flying.
I do sort of love how he introduces these idiotic cultural ideas into his reviews for stupid stuff.
Yeah, these little asides about
the
like
gems, his observations, you know.
Yeah, because they're even more kind of spacey than like Andy Rooney on 60 Minutes. Did you ever notice how flying is scary? That movie Airplane scared the hell. It's like when Homer Simpson tells Mel Brooks that that young Frankenstein scared the hell out of him. I mean, that's what Ebert is saying here. He's saying that Airplane scared him because Airplane tapped into his fear of flying. And speaking of the Simpsons, and I didn't mean to connect this, but I'm glad I did. Al Jean and Mike Reiss are given special thanks in the credits of Airplane 2, who, you know, were like producers on The Simpsons for many, many years. And I wonder what the hell they did.
Special thanks? They probably wrote some of the jokes.
Yeah. Well, apparently, I haven't seen... Have you seen the Simpsons movie?
No, I haven't.
Okay, because according to IMDb, there is a reference to Airplane 2 in it. And it's probably just something as ham-fisted as, you know...
Now,
well, I don't know. They probably don't mention their showrunners by name, but that is the reason... The reason there's a joke about Airplane 2 in the Simpsons movie is because of Al Jean and Mike Reiss.
George Wendt shows up in a second.
Oh, yeah. He's like a clerk.
He's a clerk. And I think that Cheers started in 82, and it was from Paramount. And this sort of thing, of course, could not happen today. But I almost wish they had made a third one. Not so I could see it today as an adult, but, you know, as a kid, having seen a third one and whatever the hell wacky Paramount shit they would have put into it.
Yeah, because there would have been all those TV actors in it.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been...
And TV actors to be. You would have seen, like, Peter Barton in Airplane 3.
Yeah, I mean, just this whole concept of the studio doing...
Or that Lance guy from Halloween 2, your favorite. Oh, wait, but that was Universal.
That was Universal. But even that, you know, the idea of a studio, it's like a 40s thing, you know? They did those, Warner and MGM both did them, and nobody freaking watches them today because there's no real point to it. But, you know, just the studio doing, you know, a self-congratulatory thing on
yeah.
a regular basis might have been amusing. The George Wendt cameo, he's in it for 14 seconds, and it looks like they put him in front of a truck and turned on the brights. Like, he's got to give somebody their ticket, and he's just like, here's your ticket, sir. And it's just like, wait a second, what? And but, I mean, it's just, it's, I don't know. I mean, it's nostalgic. And the, I mean, Airplane 2 has a good, fair amount of nostalgia going for it.
That's for sure. I mean,
in some ways, I would actually say more so than Airplane does. Just
no, I would say so too. Just because when someone like John Vernon shows up, you get to go, oh, cool, John Vernon.
Right. Well, that, and also I think like George Wendt, William Shatner. It's kind of like, you know, these are familiar icons in some way.
Even Sonny Bono as a terrorist, and yeah.
That joke is going to date even worse than whatever, because how much longer are people going to know who Sonny Bono is?
Yeah, and why was, and I don't know, in 1982, why is it funny to have Sonny Bono as a terrorist in 1982? I'm trying to think. When was the peak of Sonny Bono jokes?
I don't know, but did you notice all of the Arab terrorism jokes at the beginning?
Oh, yeah, boss? Yeah.
I couldn't believe that. You know, you want to make fun of the Vietnam War. This is how many years after? Yeah.
Well, they could have put Iranian hijacker jokes in the first Airplane, and it would have been more relevant than 2 years after.
Yeah, and they didn't because, you know, Vietnam's vets having troubles, funny, but, you know, that's still not, we're not ready to go there, but oh no.
Yeah.
Finkelman was just like, what the hell? Or
Finkelman's Canadian. He doesn't give a shit.
He's like, I'm never directing a movie in the States again. Let's get it going.
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, you know.
You know what I'd like to know? I would love to know the behind the scenes of Airplane 2 and, like, who they went to before they got to some nobody like Ken Finkelman.
Right. Like, what it was about Finkelman that he got to write and direct this.
Yeah, did they offer it to like the not necessarily the news people or out of work SNL writers or the right, you know, like the writing staff of Fridays maybe?
Does Finkelman have an email address? I mean, like this is the kind of thing that people need to self-record commentaries for. Airplane 2. I don't care about the commentary for Airplane 1 really. Like,
yeah.
You know, the trivia gives me, you know, the thing. Oh, you know, this is who they originally wanted for that, whatever. But no, I want to know the production history of Airplane 2, because...
Yeah.
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 It's got to be horrifying. I mean...
Right. Like, oh, we can't... I mean, imagine if you're the producer of this thing and you can't get Zaz back.
The producer is Howard W. Koch, whose name is very familiar to me for some reason. Maybe it's just from these, but I think it's...
Well, John Davison produced the first one.
Koch was the executive producer on the first one.
And that's why it still got made.
I mean, Koch did... That's what it was. Badge 373, that's where I saw his name before. That movie sucks. But no, I mean, like, Dragon Slayer, and he did a bunch of crap, and I mean, so... He'd been around forever. I mean, Koch, his first credit's from 1953.
Oh,
so.
he did some good movies in the 60s. Manchurian Candidate.
And The Odd Couple,
yeah.
So, I mean, he actually did do good stuff, and then he kind of got crappy. But, you know, and he was the Academy Awards. So it's almost like, you know, if Arthur Hiller had directed an Airplane movie, it would have been just perfect. He did Once Is Not Enough. But anyway, Koch did. But anyway. Yeah, so the Airplane movies, I think that as it gets further away from when they came out. I think that the second one gets more harsh reaction from fans of the first one. But, you know, I think that if you're going to do an airplane festival, you ought to do both of them. I mean, it's 30 minutes, or it's 3 hours, you know. It's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah. All right.
It's not going to hurt you. I mean, and the William the William Shatner stuff makes it all worth it.
It's not an American Werewolf in Paris.
No. Yeah. You know, you're going to laugh, you know.
American Werewolf in Paris would have been much better if they copied the first one to the degree that Airplane 2 does.
Oh, it would have been awesome. They should have brought back the original cast and had them play new people, play their own daughter or something. I mean, that would have just been awful. But at least, mm-hmm. you know, it would have been interesting.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Okay, then. So, in our next episode, we will be going to, speaking of the near future, we will be doing
the future of 1997. That's how near of a future we will go to.
Oh, speaking of airplanes.
Oh yeah, and speaking of terrorism and terrorism imagery.
Yeah.
Escape from New York, where an airplane crashes.
The terrorists hijack Air Force One and crash it into New York.
Not knocking down any buildings that we care about.
No, the plane shatters on impact when it hits the buildings. It's very pre-9/11. But yeah, we'll be doing that. And yeah, we know what you're thinking. You know, that's the good movie. The bad movie's got to be Escape from L.A., right? Well, you're wrong. We both like Escape from L.A. We appreciated what John Carpenter was trying to do, parodying his own movie. So our bad movie is going to be one of many Italian knockoffs of Escape from New York and Mad Max and kind of hybrids of the two knockoffs. But the bad one is 2019 After the Fall of New York, written and directed by some Italians and starring some more Italians.
With American names.
Yeah.
Don't forget.
And made somewhere in Italy. But it stars a guy who definitely was cast because of his resemblance to Kurt Russell. I don't know. We'll see. I've never seen this or any other Escape from New York knockoff, but we'll see. We'll see. The first one is my favorite John Carpenter movie, so that'll be fun to talk about too.
Yeah. Which we've never talked about, even though our first episode, of course.
Yeah, outside of that, yeah. I forgot to mention how one more thing about Airplane 2. We were talking about how you know, in the first one, the known actors parody their personas. In the second one, Finkelman kind of doesn't think we're going to remember who they are or something, so he plays the Mission Impossible theme in one of Peter Graves' scenes, and he plays a clip of the Enterprise flying through space in one of Shatner's scenes.
See, so it's good it was Paramount.
Oh, yeah, because they could do that.
Yeah.
Wow, totally. Wow. All right, newfound respect for... No, wait, no.
No.
Don't know. New understanding of Airplane 2. I can't say respect, because that's just one of those things where you don't know if the guy who's making it is dumb or if he just thinks you are. And that's the worst feeling.
It's better than every spoof comedy made in the last... When was the last good spoof comedy?
I don't know. Let's just say the last 20 years.
Yeah. Gremlins 2. I mean...
Oh, Gremlins 2. There you go. The best spoof
comedy ever. And it was in 1990.
Yeah.
So, there you go. 21 years.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, yep. That about does it. So, for an Alan Smithy podcast, this has been Matt.
And this has been Andrew.
And thanks for listening.
hope you have enjoyed this episode of the Best of an Alan Smithy podcast. This is Eva Klein. Good evening.